The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from oprahmag.com. All right, our first article is called Best-Selling Author Maria Shriver Announces a New Book Imprint. Maria Shriver, the Emmy Award-winning journalist and best-selling author of I've Been Thinking, announced that she is partnering with Penguin Life to launch her own book imprint. The Open Field, as the imprint will be called, will publish books that seek to inform, ignite, inspire, and move humanity forward one person at a time, Shriver tells OprahMag.com exclusively. They will have the mission and purpose of challenging readers to expand their minds in the quest for peace and compassion. Brian Tart, the president and publisher of Penguin Life, who has worked with Shriver on past books, says the imprint will publish roughly 3 books per year. Shriver has signed the first 2, The Call to Unite, Voices of Hope and Awakening, an anthology compiled by Tim Shriver and Tom Rossert, out on March 16th. Those contributors include Oprah Winfrey, T.D. Jakes, Arianna Huffington, and Elizabeth Gilbert, and The Way of Integrity, Finding the Path to Your True Self by Martha Beck, which will be out on April 13th. The imprint's name was inspired by Rumi, one of Shriver's favorite poets, who wrote, "Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there." Shriver hopes that the open field will be a place where visionary thinkers and artists will bring their stories to readers. "We are all moved forward by other people's stories," Shriver says. "One person, one soul, one heart at a time. Stories raise us up." Maria Shriver is a mother of 4, an Emmy and Peabody Award-winning journalist and producer, an NBC News special anchor, and the author of 7 New York Times best-selling books, as well as a best-selling coloring book for individuals with Alzheimer's and their caregivers. She is also the founder of the nonprofit The Women's Alzheimer's Movement and the media enterprise Shriver Media, which produces the highly popular online newsletter The Sunday Paper, and other digital content, documentaries, and films that ignite social conversations and inform the issues of our time. Shriver first had the idea for a book imprint when she was still the First Lady of California, with young children and a busy career as a television journalist. Whenever she met someone who inspired her, she thought, their vision, their story, should be shared in a book. Then she was juggling too much to bring this dream to life. Now, as a 65-year-old single woman with grown children, the timing is exactly right. Shriver says, "I'm hopeful that when I look back on the imprint 10 years from now, it will have become a gathering ground for influential people from all backgrounds who are having an impact on the world." Okay, still on the topic of books, here is an article called Detransition, Baby, is a boundary-breaking story of divorce and identity. In 2015, Sean Baker's indie film Tangerine premiered to virtually universal acclaim. It tells the story of a woman newly released from prison who, along with her friend, tries to track down her cheating boyfriend. The movie won praise and notoriety, partly because it was entirely shot on an iPhone 5. It also happened to star 2 trans women portrayed by actual trans women. In this sense, Tangerine served as a source of inspiration for author Tori Peters, whose new novel, Detransition, Baby, is out now. Tangerine is just a thriller, Peter tells OprahMag.com. It's a chase movie about 2 trans women tracking down a guy who's missing. It's not trying to make a point, it's just doing it. That's so powerful. Ditto for Detransition, Baby, Tori's 3rd book and first for a major publisher, a kaleidoscopic story centered on 3 individuals, a trans woman, a cisgender woman, and a man who has detransitioned, who become an unlikely, unclassifiable family unit. Yet while the book beautifully lays bare the specific plights and pratfalls of living and dating as a trans person, the novel doesn't dwell on dumbed-down identity politics, eschewing explanation in favor of a propulsive story about difficult people trying to break free of the patterns that have defined their lives. Protagonist Ames, formerly Amy, had been told by a doctor that his hormonal restructuring will most likely render him unable to bear children. It's very much a surprise, then, when Ames' lover Katrina tells him she's pregnant. Wary of traditional fatherhood and the gravity of the nuclear family, Ames puts forth a modest proposal. He and Katrina could raise the child with his ex-girlfriend Reese, a trans woman longing to be a mother. Katrina is Ames's boss, a once-married woman whose miscarriage led to a subsequent divorce. "My marriage was like a push-up bra," Katrina tells him. "It looked pretty good underneath his shirt, but you know it's all just padding, and by the end of the day you can't wait to take the damn thing off." The book is dedicated to divorced cis women who, like Peters herself, had to face starting their life over without either reinvesting in the illusions from the past or growing bitter about the future. When Peters started writing the novel, she found herself trying to reconcile what she assumed were two different audiences, cis women and trans women. But as she continued creating, she began considering what it's like to be divorced in one's 30s, which she too had gone through, and the similarities between that experience and gender transition. I looked around at my friends and my role models, and a lot of us were stuck in this kind of stasis where your 30s look a lot like your 20s, Peter says. You transition, and then you're like, well, now what? What do I do? We made a huge choice to do this, to transition. And now what are we going to do with this huge choice? It was then she discovered the readership she once thought of as bifurcated was actually the same audience. As Reese tells Katrina, divorce is a transition story, especially for women who felt their divorce as a fall. The ones who have seen how the narratives given to them since girlhood have failed them, and who know there is nothing to replace it all. Dynamic and vibrant, Detransition, Baby, is a book about womanhood that happens to star two trans women. It is a fiercely confident novel about aging, about how to make meaning out of one's life, how to escape the traditional definitions of how one ought to be. The question for me, Peter says, wasn't so much to prescribe a way that you should live, so much as a way to say, come on, let's live. And now I'm going to read some little-known Black history facts you may not have learned in school. These span various topics that will inspire you to take your research beyond Black History Month. From the hidden figures that made an impact, essential Black inventors, change-making civil rights leaders, award-winning authors, and show-stopping 21st century women, Black history is rich in America. Resources like blackpast.org, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and the Library of Congress are great ways to expand on your knowledge as well as learn little-known Black history facts to further your understanding of African American culture. We've gathered a few choice bits of trivia spanning various topics, and here we go. Starting with literature, Phyllis Wheatley was the first African American to publish a book of poetry, poems on various subjects, religious and moral, in 1773. Born in Gambia and sold to the Wheatley family in Boston when she was 7 years old, Wheatley was emancipated shortly after her book was released. Bars Fight, written by poet and activist Lucy Terry in 1746, was the first known poem written by a Black American. Terry was enslaved in Rhode Island as a toddler, but became free at the age of 26 after marrying a free Black man. Clotel or The President's Daughter was the first novel published by an African American in 1853. It was written by abolitionist and lecturer William Wells Brown. And here's some other important figures. William Tucker was the first known black person to be born in the 13 colonies. He was born in Jamestown, Virginia in 1624. According to blackpast.org, his parents were indentured servants and part of the first group of Africans brought to colonial soil by Great Britain. Anthony Benezet, a white Quaker, abolitionist, and educator, is credited with creating the first public school for African American children in the early 1770s. After graduating from Oberlin College in 1850 with a literary degree, Lucy Stanton became the first black woman in America to earn a four-year college degree. And now we're going to talk about music and television. Dubbed hip-hop's first godmother by Billboard, singer and music producer Sylvia Robinson produced the first ever commercially successful rap record, Rapper's Delight, by the Sugar Hill Gang. And along with her husband, she co-owned the first hip-hop label, Sugar Hill Records. Renowned singer and jazz pianist Nat King Cole was the first black American to host a TV show, NBC's The Nat King Cole Show. Stevie Wonder is not only the first black artist to win a Grammy for Album of the Year for 1973's Inner Visions, but the first and only musician to win Album of the Year with three consecutive studio albums. In 1981, broadcast journalist Bryant Gumbel became the first black person to host a network morning show when he joined NBC's Today Show. In 1940, Hattie McDaniel became the first black person to win an Oscar for her supporting role in Gone with the Wind. 24 years later, Sidney Poitier became the first black man to win an Oscar for his leading role in Lilies of the Field. And now I'm going to talk about some inventors. Hairdresser Christina Jenkins is credited with inventing the weave. Also known as a sew-in, the Louisiana native, who eventually relocated to Ohio, earned a patent for her creation in 1952, though it was overturned in 1965, according to Stylist. Computer scientist Lisa Globter assisted with the 1995 creation of Shockwave, essential technology that led to the development of web animation. So we have her to thank for GIFs, or GIFs if you're one of those people who pronounces them like that. Agricultural scientist George Carver was responsible for creating over 500 new products made from peanuts and sweet potatoes, including cooking oils, paint, and soap. Okay, and now we're going to talk about sports. In 1908, after winning the 4x400-meter relay, John Taylor became the first African American to win gold in the Olympics. In 1948, Alice Coachman became the first black woman in the world to win an Olympic gold medal while competing in the high jump. Founded in 1984, the Bill Pickett Invitational Rodeo is the only touring African-American rodeo in the world. In 1920, Fritz Pollard and Bobby Marshall became the first black athletes to play in the NFL. Pollard was also the league's first black coach. In 2012, at the London Olympics, Gabby Douglas became the first black gymnast to win the individual all-around title. In 1996, Cheryl Swoopes became the first player to sign with the WNBA, with the league debuting a year later. And the final category we'll discuss is society and life. First published in 1936, Negro Motorist Green Book was a comprehensive guide for black travelers about locations across America and eventually overseas that were either black-owned or did not engage in segregationist practices. The guide was printed for 30 years. It stopped publication in 1966 2 years after the Civil Rights Act was passed. The oldest black female Greek letter organization, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, aka, was founded at Howard University in 1908. Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity, Alpha, the first black male Greek letter organization, was founded in 1906 at Cornell. It's estimated that around 100,000 enslaved people escaped to the North via the Underground Railroad from 1810 to 1850. In July 1777, Vermont became the first colony to ban slavery. In 1738, a group of newly freed men and women founded the town Gracia Real de Santa Teresa de Mos in Florida. Just 2 miles away from St. Augustine, it's considered to be the first ever free black settlement in the United States, but was abandoned following the Seven Years' War in 1763. Okay, here's an article called Celebrities Who Admitted They Hate Their Iconic Roles. Whether it's the character or how they played it, these stars spoke out. As an actor, you have to be adept on taking various personalities, motivations, and even looks for different parts. But certain stars still deal with the recognition that comes with playing an iconic role, and some of them don't love that. Whether they hated their character or just hated the fame that came with it, take a look at the stars who definitely see their roles as a blessing, but sometimes also as a curse. First, we have Allison Williams, who played Marnie on Girls. "Marnie would drive me crazy if we were friends in real life," she told BuzzFeed. "But I have to put that out of my head in order to play her. Like, sleeping with Elijah," played by Andrew Rannells, "is crazy. Sleeping with Ray, that's crazy. Furiously hitting on Desi when he mentions his girlfriend in their first conversation is crazy. But I have to be on the couch with her and Elijah hoping they fuck. I have to be in that apartment with Ray kind of wanting it to happen. And I have to support her quest for Desi." But the thing Williams struggled with most was Marnie's decision to sleep with artist Booth Jonathan in season 2 of Girls. "I was fighting that the whole time as Allison," she says with a sigh. "I did not want her to go down that road. I thought Marnie was better than that. But she wasn't, so I had to be okay with it too. I had to believe Booth was a genius when I walked out of that TV tower, whereas I, as Allison, couldn't stop thinking, it puts the lotion on its skin." And here's what Rob Pattinson says about his role in Twilight. "Robert Pattinson hates Twilight, hates Edward, and hates how everyone likes both. P.S. There's even a Tumblr devoted to his interviews where he has to talk about Twilight and ultimately makes fun of it. Perhaps the best quote, he's the most ridiculous person. The more I read the script, the more I hated this guy. Plus, he's a 108-year-old virgin, so he's obviously got some issues there." Okay, and here is Kate Winslet talking about her role in Titanic. "Even though Kate doesn't hate Titanic the film, she's not too thrilled with her performance as Rose when she looks back. Every single scene, I'm like, really? Really? You did it like that? Oh my God. Even my American accent, I can't listen to it. It's awful," she told The Telegraph. "Hopefully it's so much better now. It sounds terribly self-indulgent, but actors do tend to be very self-critical. I have a hard time watching any of my performances, but watching Titanic, I was just like, oh my God, I want to do that again." Adam Brody in The O.C. It's not that Adam Brody hates the character he played on The O.C. It's that he hates talking about him now, which is understandable. In an interview with The Huffington Post, the actor got candid about why he's kind of annoyed to keep talking about Seth. "It gets boring, that's all. The only way it bothers me, it's not that I'm not proud of it, it's that I've exhausted the conversations about it in my mind. I mean, forgive me for comparing myself in any way, and I'm not, but Harrison Ford, I understand why he would be crotchety talking about Star Wars." Blake Lively in Gossip Girl. In an interview with Allure, Lively explained that playing such a privileged and troubled character on Gossip Girl was at times personally compromising. It's a weird thing when people feel like they know you really well and they don't, Lively said. I would not be proud to be the person who gave someone the cocaine that made them overdose and then shot someone and slept with someone else's boyfriend. People loved it, but it always felt a little personally compromising. You want to be putting a better message out there, she said. The lines become blurred. It doesn't help when everybody's dating who they're dating on the show, and you're also saying to the costume designer, hey, can I take that home? Megan Fox, Transformers. As the star of the first two Transformers films, when asked whether she'd star in a third, Fox told Entertainment Weekly, sure, I mean, I can't shit on this movie because it did give me a career and open all those doors for me. But I don't want to blow smoke up people's ass. People are well aware that this is not a movie about acting. And once you realize that, it becomes almost fun because you can be in the moment and go, all right, I know that when he calls action, I'm either going to be running or screaming or both. She also later called director Michael Bay both misogynistic and a nightmare, saying that he once had her clean his Ferrari and had her on a skin tanning regimen. Colin Farrell, Miami Vice. Farrell starred in the 2006 film alongside Jamie Foxx and clearly was not a fan. Miami Vice? I didn't like it so much, said Farrell in 2010. I thought it was style over substance, and I accept a good bit of the responsibility. Justin Guarini, from Justin to Kelly. On a 2013 episode of Oprah, Where Are They Now?, Guarini called the 2000 film abysmal. Although he did call the production an unbelievable experience. Guarini starred alongside Kelly Clarkson in the 2003 musical comedy after Clarkson won the first season of American Idol and Guarini was the runner-up. Kelly Clarkson from Justin to Kelly. Clarkson wasn't a fan of it either. In a 2015 interview with Rolling Stone, she was asked whether she burned all of the copies of the film yet, to which she replied, no, I think I would have to own it first, but that is something I will look into. I have a little joke with our nanny because she told me she loves that movie. She was like, my roommate and I used to watch it all the time. I'm totally going to show your daughter From Justin to Kelly. And I'm like, I will fire you. Brad Pitt, The Devil's Own. In a 1997 issue of Newsweek, Pitt admits the thriller drama released the same year was the most irresponsible bit of filmmaking, if you can even call it that, that I've ever seen. Penn Bagley, Gossip Girl. Though Bagley didn't directly state he hated his character on Gossip Girl, he did reference the show and its flaws on multiple occasions. He tweeted in 2015, LOL shit, we are reclining on New York City. I'm posted up like it's a futon. Talk about an image of white privilege. He also told Salon back in 2013, to be proud of something is a really nice feeling. And it's a new feeling. It's something I want to keep going with. Gossip Girl aired from 2007 to 2012, so you can do the math. Cher, Burlesque. It could have been a much better film. It was always sad that it was not a good film, she told The Guardian in 2013, calling director Steve Anton a really terrible director. I remember Anton saying to me, I don't care about what you say, I just want to shoot the dance numbers. Jim Carrey on his role in Kick-Ass 2. Carrey starred in the 2013 thriller Kick-Ass 2, released less than a year following the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. He tweeted, I did Kick-Ass a month before Sandy Hook, and now in all good conscience, I cannot support that level of violence. Katherine Heigl, Knocked Up. When asked about the 2007 film, Heigl told Vanity Fair, it was a little sexist. It paints the women as shrews, as humorless and uptight. I had a hard time with it on some days. I'm playing such a bitch. Why is she being such a killjoy? Why is this how you're portraying women? 98% of the time, it was an amazing experience, but it was hard for me to love the movie. Jennifer Garner, Elektra. Garner called her 2005 movie Elektra awful, according to her ex-boyfriend Michael Vartan. In an interview with Us Weekly, Vartan is quoted as saying, "I heard Elektra was awful. Jennifer called me and told me it was awful. She had to do it because of Daredevil. It was in her contract." Shia LaBeouf, Indiana Jones. LaBeouf played Mutt in the 2008 film Indiana Jones. "I feel like I dropped the ball on the legacy that people loved and cherished," he told the LA Times. "You get to monkey swinging and things like that, and you can blame it on the writer, and you can blame it on Steven Spielberg. But the actor's job is to make it come alive and make it work. And I couldn't do it. So that's my fault. Simple." LaBeouf's character won't be returning for a sequel. Jamie Foxx, Stealth. During his promotion for The Kingdom, Foxx reportedly said he was glad he didn't have to lie and say it was good, like he'd had to do with Stealth. He also said, "Sometimes you do a movie and you have to go promote it. So on Stealth, I was like, yeah, this is the greatest. And people would see me after seeing the movie and say, I cannot believe you lied to me like that." Sarah Jessica Parker, Sex and the City 2. Sex and the City 2 didn't go over as well by fans as the series did. Speaking at Vulture Festival earlier this month, Parker admitted she can see where we fell short. "I understand. I actually get it. I will say I also understand how much frickin' money it's made," she added. "I feel like that's what's forgotten in the discussion." Jason Bateman, Horrible Bosses 2. "Indifference says a lot. The second one was garbage as far as the box office goes," said Bateman of the 2014 film. "Who knows whether it was on the merits or when they released it, but it did not do any money." Channing Tatum, G.I. Joe, Rise of Cobra. On Howard Stern's radio show, Tatum told the host, "I'll be honest, I fucking hate that movie. I was pushed into doing it. The script wasn't any good, and I didn't want to do something that I was a fan of since I was a kid and watched every morning growing up. I didn't want to do something that was, number one, bad, and number two, I just didn't know if I wanted to be G.I. Joe." Shailene Woodley, The Secret Life of the American Teenager. Woodley played Amy on The Secret Life of the American Teenager for 5 years. Toward the end, morally, the things that we were preaching on the show weren't aligned with my own integrity, she said. So that was a bit hard, to show up to work every day knowing that we were going to project all of these themes to thousands, millions of young adults across the country, when in fact they weren't what I would like to be sending out. Charlize Theron, Reindeer Games. When asked about the 2000 movie, Theron simply stated, "That was a bad, bad, bad movie." Sally Field, The Amazing Spider-Man. Field was not a fan of the Spider-Man sequel. "It's really hard to find a three-dimensional character in it, and you work as much as you can, but you can't put 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag." That's what she told Howard Stern. James Franco, Your Highness. "Your Highness? Ugh, that movie sucks," Franco told GQ of the medieval parody. "You can't get around that." Zac Efron, High School Musical. We may love Troy Bolton, but Efron certainly doesn't. "I step back and look at myself, and I still want to kick that guy's ass sometimes," he said. "He's done some kind of cool things with some cool people. He did that one thing that was funny, but I mean, he's still just that fucking kid from High School Musical." Shia LaBeouf, Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen. LaBeouf admits, "I wasn't impressed with what we did. There were some really wild stunts in it, but the heart was gone. It's just a bunch of fighting robots." He also took a nap during the screening. Mariah Carey, Glitter. Carey plays herself in the 2001 film Glitter and was definitely not a fan. She told Andy Cohen it was her biggest regret. "It was a horrible couple of years, and then I had to get my momentum back for people to let it go." Cara Delevingne, Paper Towns. Okay, she isn't actually being serious about this one, but during a morning TV interview, Delevingne was asked if she had anything in common with her character Margot. She jokingly replied, "No, I actually hate her." And let's just say things got a tad awkward from there. George Clooney, Batman and Robin. Even George Clooney doesn't love every role he stars in, and he continuously apologizes for his role in Batman 17 years later. Let me just say that I actually thought I'd destroyed the franchise until somebody else brought it back years later and changed it. I thought at the time it was going to be a very good career move. It wasn't. Mark Wahlberg, The Happening. Wahlberg starred in the 2008 film and admits, "Oh, I was such a huge fan of Amy Adams. We'd actually talked about another movie, and it was a bad movie that I did. She dodged the bullet. I don't want to tell you what movie." All right, The Happening, fuck it. Fucking trees, man. Daniel Craig, James Bond. Craig is no doubt tired of the Bond series. When asked if he could imagine doing another Bond movie in 2015, Craig told Time Out, "Now? I'd rather break this glass and slash my wrist." "No, not at the moment, not at all. That's fine. I'm over it at the moment. We are done. All I want to do is move on." Jennifer Lawrence, Mother. Lawrence's first reaction to seeing the 2017 horror film wasn't the best. "I was really shaken. My first reaction to seeing the film was that we took it too far," said Lawrence. "But then after the images died down a little bit, the movie is exactly what we're supposed to be doing and what we need to be doing. We have a message, and if we wanted it watered down to make people comfortable, well, then what's the point? Why even make it?" Jessica Alba, Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer. In a 2010 interview, Alba told Elle that she almost quit acting after working on the superhero sequel because director Tim Story told her she wasn't crying pretty enough. Lindsay Lohan, I Know Who Killed Me. While celebrating her 27th birthday in rehab, Lohan replied to a fan who wished her a happy birthday and said, "I seriously watched I Know Who Killed Me twice last night." The actress then responded, "Two times too many." Sylvester Stallone, Stop or Mom Will Shoot. The iconic actor, known for his roles in Rocky, talked to GQ about the 1992 comedy, which was maybe one of the worst films in the entire solar system, including alien productions we've never seen. Christian Bale, Newsies. "Time healed those wounds, but it took a while," Bale told Entertainment Weekly about the 1992 film. Ben Affleck, Daredevil. Affleck revealed during a Times talk he regretted doing the 2003 superhero film, which bombed at the box office. "Part of it was I wanted for once to do one of these movies and do it right, do a good version. Ugh, I hate Daredevil so much." Halle Berry, Catwoman. Berry hated the 2004 film she starred in. In 2005, the actress accepted an award on stage, stating, "I want to thank Warner Brothers for casting me in this piece of shit, god-awful movie." Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Radcliffe admitted in an interview with Playboy he doesn't like watching the 2009 film because I'm just not very good in it. "I hate it. My acting is very one-note and complacent, and what I did, I was just trying to do, it just didn't come across. My best film is the fifth one, Order of the Phoenix, because I can see a progression." Carrie Fisher, Star Wars. Despite the film's huge success, this was actually a big reason why Fisher regretted the role. Fisher admitted to Today, "I wish I'd turned down Star Wars." Arnold Schwarzenegger, Red Sonja. Schwarzenegger starred in the 1980 film, revealing, "It's the worst film I have ever made. When my kids get out of line, they're sent to their rooms and forced to watch Red Sonja 10 times. I never had too much trouble with them." Ben Affleck, Gigli. In a Times Talk interview, Affleck revealed, "It could have been a bad movie no one cared about. Angelina Jolie had a bad movie that year. No one cared. But it was because I was dating Jennifer Lopez that it made it a big fucking deal. So not only was it a bad movie, but they dated each other." Alec Baldwin, Rock of Ages. Alec Baldwin, Rock of Ages. Baldwin told The Wrap the 2012 film was a complete disaster and that a weekend you go, "Oh God, what have I done?" Matt Damon, The Bourne Ultimatum. Damon hated the third film in the Bourne series. I don't blame Tony for taking a boatload of money and handing in what he handed in. It's just that it was unreadable. This is a career ender. It's terrible. It's really embarrassing. He took his money and he left. Bruce Willis, multiple films. Though he hasn't admitted which films he hates exactly, when asked if he regrets making any of his 60-plus films, Willis revealed, "About a dozen. I'd love to strike them off the list." He's also admitted he's bored of making action movies. Michelle Pfeiffer, Grease 2. Pfeiffer revealed in 2007, "I hated that film with a vengeance and could not believe how bad it was. At the time, I was young and didn't know any better." Miley Cyrus, Hannah Montana. While Cyrus doesn't directly reference she hated her character or the show, she does talk about the negative effect it had on her. "I was told for so long what a girl is supposed to be from being on that show," she told Marie Claire in 2015. "I was made to look like someone that I wasn't, which probably caused some body dysmorphia, because I had been made pretty every day for so long. And then when I wasn't on that show, I was like, who the fuck am I?" Harrison Ford, Blade Runner. Before the 2017 release of Blade Runner 2049, there was the original Blade Runner, though in 1999, Ford revealed he wasn't a fan. "I didn't like the movie one way or the other, with or without. I played a detective who did not have any detecting to do. In terms of how I related to the material, I found it very difficult. There was stuff going on that was really nuts." Matthew Good, Leap Year. Good didn't even particularly want his role in the 2010 film in the first place. "The main reason I took it is so that I could come home at the weekends," he said. "It wasn't because of the script, trust me. Do I feel I let myself down? No. Was it a bad job? Yes, it was. But you know, I had a nice time and I got paid." Rooney Mara, Pan. Mara hated the lack of diversity in the 2015 film Pan. She revealed in 2016, "I really hate that I am on that side of the whitewashing conversation. I really do. I don't ever want to be on that side of it again." I can understand why people were upset and frustrated. All right, now I'm going to read an article called "Ugandan Climate Activist Vanessa Nakate Will Release Her First Book This Fall." A bigger picture is about the 24-year-old's fight for climate justice. This November, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt will publish 24-year-old Ugandan climate activist Vanessa Nakate's book, "A Bigger Picture, My Fight to Bring a New African Voice to the Climate Crisis." The book, which OprahMag.com is exclusively announcing today, is about Nakate's road to empowerment and how others can follow her lead. I couldn't be more excited or proud to help bring Vanessa Nakate's incredible, world-changing activism to readers, acquiring editor Rakia Clark tells OprahMag.com. Vanessa's emerged as one of the most important and critical voices on climate justice and race. I can't wait for American audiences to get more familiar with her work and to be inspired to take action. Nakate first drew worldwide attention when she stood alongside Greta Thunberg and four other young white European climate activists at Davos in 2020. But in the group photo that the AP syndicated, Nakate's image was inexplicably cut out. As Nakate said at the time, "The cropping made it possible to believe that African climate activists were absent, that Africans were not active in the climate change movement, and that there was not a global youth climate movement that included people like me and many others in Africa, Asia, and Latin America." For Nakate, the omission highlighted the intersection between climate change and racial and social justice, and that often those least responsible for climate change, such as Africans and inhabitants of the global South, are the people most impacted by it. Nakate is determined to ensure that those voices are finally heard. In an interview with OprahMag.com, she spoke from Kampala about being a shy loner who was inspired to take action on behalf of her country and her continent by the example of her parents, who work within their communities to combat hunger, healthcare issues, and deforestation, and by young climate activists such as Turnberg and others. Right now, Nakate says, people don't understand the urgency of the climate crisis. In my part of the world and others, people are being left with nothing, no food, no water, no place to live, as a direct result of climate change. And we will never get to zero hunger or achieve gender equality or lift millions from poverty without addressing climate change. She vows to use her voice, to use every resource I have to address the world's greatest threat. The book, which Nakate describes as a memoir and a manifesto, will chronicle her journey to activism, document the most urgent issues facing her community, and offer ideas on sustainable solutions and other ways readers can engage around the problem. Like millions of others around the globe, Nakate watched youth inaugural poet Amanda Gorman recite her poem at the presidential inauguration on January 20th and was inspired. When asked about young women like herself and like Gorman who are raising their voices to make change in the world, Nakate said, "Young women are the light this world needs right now. Young women are the solution the world needs, yet few have been given the platform to speak their truth. There is power in our voices. There is power in our activism. There are so many young women who haven't yet gotten the platforms to tell their stories. We need to give them those platforms." Okay, next we have an article called, "Is It Healthy to Be a Hopeless Romantic? Love is always in style, but not when it shrinks your sense of self." For the hopeless romantic, love is the pulse of life, the most intoxicating rush of all. Hopeless romantics live for sparks and butterflies in their bellies, often dreaming of fateful encounters and wedding vows that land like poetry. Sex in the City's Charlotte is an example. Cue her famous lines, "I've been dating since I was 15, I'm exhausted. Where is he?" But people do live happily ever after. While throughout the series, each of the women encountered red-hot liaisons that turned out to be letdowns, often growing so disheartened that they considered giving up on romance altogether, Charlotte never did. If you can relate, listen up. We chatted with experts about the signs, benefits, and potential risk of being a hopeless romantic. Plus, they offered a more hopeful alternative. And hey, you might be surprised to learn that prioritizing logic isn't necessarily a bad thing, nor does it have to mean turning your back on passion. Rom-coms aside, here are the classic signs of a hopeless romantic. For this type of person, there's always time for pillow talk, to send an amorous text to say I love you, or to have wine and dinner by candlelight. And no matter how many painful breakups they've been through, their quest for love persists. This person can't imagine their future without a big, cinematic love story. A hopeless romantic is someone who loves the idea of being in love and tends to think of love as having fairy tale qualities. They might strongly believe in the idea of love at first sight and that there is one perfect partner out there for them who will appear one day and sweep them off their feet, says Dr. Justin Lemeler, social psychologist and Astroglide's resident sex researcher. Catherine Hertline, PhD, LMFT, professor of couple and family therapy at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas School of Medicine, says the hallmark of a hopeless romantic is that they place romantic love in a privileged position in their lives, whether they're in a relationship or in the pursuit of one. This person lives with constant hope that the fantasy of a perfect romantic love will play out, she says. It's the friend who's had a Pinterest board of whimsical wedding inspiration since college, despite never having been engaged. The one who falls fast and hard for a handsome suitor while swiping through a dating app, then gushes about a picture of him and his dog for the rest of the night. Love drives their inspirations and shapes their decisions. According to Heartline, hopeless romantics are more likely to prioritize communication, avoid game playing, and reject cynicism from external influences. She emphasizes, a healthy dose of romance helps one assume good intentions in their partner. Being romantic allows someone to be vulnerable and to take appropriate risk, she says. Hopeless romantics are more likely to ignore warning signs, social cues and boundaries, throwing themselves into not well thought out scenarios in order to experience love. They are prone to idolize their love interest, not always because they're in love with that person, but rather the feeling itself. Dr. Edith Eger, psychologist and best-selling author of The Gift, 12 Lessons to Save Your Life, says that dysfunction starts to brew when self-care takes a back seat. Romance is wonderful, but not when it becomes so important that a person stops taking responsibility for their own happiness. Romantic interest should never become such a priority that a person puts their life in someone else's hands. In some cases, being a hopeless romantic can create the opposite of what's truly desired. It's typical for hopeless romantics to hold an unwavering belief in destiny, to believe that one day they'll be gazing into the adoring eyes of the one. Dr. Lemeler says that while it's perfectly normal to find the idea of a once-in-a-lifetime fairy tale appealing, it can actually hinder a person from forging a love that's deep and abiding. Research tells us that people with strong destiny beliefs tend to have a harder time making relationships last. Rather than working through conflicts that might arise, they are often quick to plot an exit strategy, taking it as a sign that things are not meant to be. Then they might never learn the skills necessary to maintain a healthy relationship. In such a case, the hopeless romantic might be so enthralled with their ideologies and so void of realistic expectations that they unknowingly sabotage their shot at lasting love before it has a prayer to thrive. So how do you know when romantic inclinations have become counterproductive? Barner warns about the signs that a flair for romanticism might be a hindrance. Each involves prioritizing fantasy over truth. People who have unhealthy inclinations toward romance often create shrines honoring their love interest or partner, exaggerating things in order to convince themselves that their relationship is more than what it is. They also might become defensive when told an undesired truth about their relationship, even if it is from a trusted source, she says. Another sign is that they're fueled by a lack of reciprocation. Some hopeless romantics are not turned off by a one-sided relationship. When their love interest or partner makes no effort, they might make it their mission to eventually conquer them, she says. Heartline agrees, adding that one should not become so swept away by their desires that they never take off their rose-colored glasses. Especially if the relationship is making them sad or stressed, it's dangerous for a hopeless romantic to be in an emotionally or physically abusive situation because they might be so set on seeing their partner in a positive light that they might not be aware of what's happening, she says. In other words, hopeless romantics must take caution to not become so captivated by the idea of a storybook ending that they gloss over reality, abandon their instincts, and ignore mounting evidence. The opposite of a hopeless romantic is a realist. Unlike the hopeless romantic, realists crave predictability and stability, not fireworks. But while this personality type boasts advantages, It threatens to siphon the spontaneity and excitement from a love affair. In the worst cases, extreme realism can tip towards cynicism, which can be a total buzzkill to even the strongest of bonds. Barner stresses that while too much romanticism can lead to the kind of paralyzing adoration and idolatry that suffocates a relationship's ability to progress, being too rooted in realism can cause the relationship to become a snooze. While that's perfectly normal to happen over time, passion is the force that drives a relationship and compels people toward commitment, action, and connection. Without it, love would be nothing more than a concept, she says. Experts say there is a better alternative to being a hopeless romantic, the hopeful romantic. This romantic mindset involves being passionate, yet pragmatic. And most interestingly, it's more likely to spawn the kind of love story that a hopeless romantic ultimately craves. Being a hopeful romantic involves sharing some belief in relationship destiny, but means having a growth mindset at the same time. So rather than seeing a manageable conflict as a sign that the relationship is wrong, a hopeful romantic views it as a challenge to overcome, one that will make the relationship stronger if that can happen in a healthy way. Being hopefully romantic over hopelessly romantic might reap some steamy rewards in the bedroom as well. Instead of viewing a decline in passion as a sign of being poorly matched with their partner, the hopeful romantic might view it as a sign that it's time to have an open conversation about intimacy. While hair-raising romance is a pleasure in life, it should coexist with some level of realism, even if fanciful thinking is most often taking the driver's seat. While setting the stage for a romantic atmosphere can be fun and keep the flames of excitement flickering, the main objective should be to build deep, lasting intimacy instead of chasing big, idealistic displays of affection. You can be a passionate person and love being in love, but also unwilling to risk your emotional security and mental health for a relationship. This means approaching relationships with hopeful caution, never lying to yourself in order to preserve a fairy tale, and only giving as much of yourself as reality warrants, she says. Because at the end of the day, the real romance begins within. Dr. Eager believes that falling in love with yourself is a prerequisite to building a fulfilling relationship with someone else, and that the rejection of self is the most tragic of all. Which is also to say that the realest happily ever after you could ever have is within. The only one you can ever really lose is you, she says. People often search for that perfect partner to cherish them. But the real love story is cherishing yourself. Or, to tie it back to Sex and the City, if we may, as Carrie Bradshaw once said, the most exciting, challenging, and significant relationship of all is the one you have with yourself. And if you can find someone to love you that you love, well, that's just fabulous. And sticking with the love theme, here are three major things to consider if you're thinking about getting engaged. If one of your 2021 resolutions was to change your relationship status from in a relationship to married, you've already conquered the hardest part of making it to the altar, finding a compatible partner. Whether you're paired up with long-term love that's been by your side for years, or a recent romance that blossomed during lockdown, there are a few important things to think about when you're ready to make a lifelong commitment. First, there is no need to wonder whether it's unromantic to raise the issue. Surprise engagements might fill our social media feed from time to time, but the question of whether and when to marry is more and more often a direct conversation, according to the editor and founder of Engagement 101. There's more equality in relationships in terms of career and finances than earlier generations, And a lot of couples already live together when they get engaged, she explains. But whether you're sharing a lease or not, important milestones are often good opportunities to talk in concrete terms about what comes next. Marriage is usually part of the conversation when couples start thinking about the future in more specific terms. The ring. Engagement rings have remained an important symbol that represents a couple's commitment. But the notion that the price of an engagement ring should equal 2 months' salary is wildly out of date. It's another category that, thankfully, has evolved with the times and reflects the reality that couples have to juggle lots of different priorities when planning for marriage. Personal style reigns supreme when choosing a specific ring, while diamond solitaires remain a classic and popular choice. There are beautiful alternatives that didn't exist a generation ago. There's a current wave of independent jewelry designers, many of whom are women themselves, that bring standout touches to their engagement ring designs, including textured gold settings, unexpected materials like enamel, and contemporary shapes that break the mold. All right, now what about the proposal? As for the mechanics of who pops the question, there are no fixed rules. If a couple believes in very traditional roles, their proposal style will probably reflect that, says Ferrari. But there's been a shift toward less conventional approaches, especially among younger couples. Gen Z isn't really into established gender roles, she explains. While men often still do the asking in heterosexual couples, there's a growing trend of women proposing and contributing their own money to buying an engagement ring, and mutual proposals are happening too. A word of advice for whoever decides to do the asking: make the moment about your partner. Think of the proposal as a chance to make your partner feel special. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number was 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.